Episode 288 of the Pilot the Pilot podcast takes off now. Fly with Garmin Avionics? Then grab your mobile device and make the Garmin Pilot app your cockpit companion. Get advanced functions you'll use before, during, and after every flight, including updating your aircraft's databases and logging engine data. Plan, file, fly, log with Garmin Pilot.
The Pilot to Pilot podcast is brought to you by Learn the Finer Points. Use the link below to save 10% off their ground school app.
Aviation, there's a new offer from SiriusXM. Make sure you upgrade your next flight without upgrading your plane by getting the Garmin GDL52 portable receiver. The GDL52 has ADS-B traffic and weather, plus SiriusXM weather and entertainment. It has Bluetooth and works with Garmin Pilot apps. For a limited time, you can get a $300 rebate on the GDL52. Plus, it comes with a free 3-month trial of SiriusXM's weather and entertainment. I love flying with SiriusXM, and it's honestly one of my favorite features about having the G5000. So the GDL52 will offer you a very similar outlook on the weather and also getting to listen to some awesome radio stations on SiriusXM. So check out the GDL52 at aopa.org/SiriusXM. Aviation, what is going on? And welcome back to the Pilot to Pilot podcast. My name is Justin Seams, and I am your host. Today's episode is with Mace Curran. Mace is a former Thunderbird United States Air Force fighter pilot, which is unbelievable, and she's also a great author. I have to give a special shout out because it was my neighbor's birthday, Lily, and in the book, Lily Padilly becomes a fighter pilot. So it has been really cool to see her read that, and now she's always asking her dad and her mom if she can go fly, and by that, holding her arms and just spin around like she's flying an airplane. So Mace, thank you so much for that book. It's so cool. I'm really excited to have Mace on. It's not many times you get to talk to a Thunderbird. I think this is number two, but it's a great time having someone on that just accomplished so many cool things in life, and just to hear their stories and how they became a Thunderbird pilot and what they're doing today. One quick note, there was some issues with the last two episodes. For some reason, they were not being updated to Apple Podcasts. Everything should be fixed now. If you're still having issues, let me know, but there's been two great episodes that you need to go listen to that just for some reason were never published, having issues with my distributor, but hopefully it's all good now. But Aviation, I want to keep you much longer. I'm going back on the road today. Had a wedding in Canada, lost my voice, so if I sound weird, that's why. But I hope you're having a great day. And without any further ado, here's Mace Curran. Mace, what's going on? Welcome to the Pilot to Pilot podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm excited. This is a long time coming. I reached out to you probably like 5 years ago, it feels like now, to start out with. And I think I dropped the ball. I don't think I ever reached out to the people that needed to clear it. So now here we are, though, just 5 years later.
Oh, it's a lot easier to get cleared once I'm no longer on active duty. Turns out it's just me saying yes. So here we are.
Well, cool. Well, thank you for coming on. I appreciate it. The first question I ask everyone is, why aviation? What was it about aviation that wanted you to get involved in it?
So I kind of stumbled into it. It wasn't something that was my dream from the time I was a little kid. I would get asked a lot when I was flying for the Thunderbirds if I had seen the team fly when I was a kid and had that kind of moment where I'm like, oh, cool jets, I'm going to go do that someday. And for me, I grew up in a small town in northern Wisconsin, not an aviation family, not a military family. So I didn't really have exposure to that. I grew up only about a 2-hour drive from EAA Oshkosh.
Oh, dang.
But I had never been until last year, which really? Always blows people's minds. Yeah, I never went as a kid. I just didn't know about it. I don't think my parents knew about it. But I needed a way to pay for college. And we started to explore scholarship opportunities. And Air Force ROTC kind of filtered to the top. I ended up getting a full ride, which is pretty awesome. But at that point, I went to college as a criminal justice major because I had a grand plan of doing 4 years in the Air Force to pay back my scholarship time, probably doing special investigations. And then I wanted to go get out of active duty and go to the FBI. And so that was kind of my grand plan as like a junior in high school. And then about halfway through college, while I was in ROTC, we went on a base visit down to Tyndall Air Force Base. And I had seen a few fighter aircraft flying at a distance at that point, but I actually had to stand on the ramp and watch two F-15s take off in full afterburner. And it was at dusk, so the AB was just like that glowing flame out the back. You know, the jet noise is, it's a visceral experience. It gives you goosebumps. It vibrates your whole body. And I was just like, well, forget the FBI. Like, holy crap, how do I go do that?
Yeah, FBI's boring. I want to fly that.
Right? Who wants to kick down doors? Let's go fly jets.
Yeah.
So that was kind of the moment where in various classes and stuff in ROTC, the cadre would be like, who here wants to be a pilot? And I'd always been like, oh, I'm undecided. I don't know. You know, when you raise your hand, now everyone's looking at you and holding you accountable to see if you actually go do the thing that you want to do. And I hadn't been putting my hand up. And after that, I started raising my hand. And then there was one Air Force officer who was one of our professors who would be like, okay, and who wants to be a fighter pilot? And so then I doubled down and I kept my hand in the air. And it was kind of fighter, jets or bust for me. So it's a little bit of a non-traditional path, right? I think a lot of people start to explore aviation with their private pilot's license. They get some hours while they're in high school. They kind of dabble in general aviation. Then maybe they decide the military route is right for them. I just went all in. I showed up to pilot training day one with a zero flight time, which is aggressive. Not the best technique. Maybe it was tough at first. But yeah, so that's kind of how I got sent down that path.
Well, so you see these F-15s, and you have this idea like, oh, cool, I want to fly. Did you have any idea what it like entailed, what it took to become a pilot at that point? Was it just kind of like a pipe dream? Or like, honestly, was it just like, I'm going to do that no matter what? Like, that's what I've been called to do.
I think the second, like I was a very, I've always been very driven and kind of determined when I set my sights on something. I'm like, okay, what do we need to do to make this happen? And I'll put in all the work that needs to get done to get there. But I definitely did not realize what it all entailed. I knew I had to compete against my other ROTC cadets to get a pilot slot. And then from there, I knew pilot training was competitive and there weren't a lot of fighter aircraft available. And it was, you know, the odds were not in my favor that I would get one. And then I really had no idea what it actually meant to be a fighter pilot. And I didn't really figure that out until I got to my first operational unit after I'd already gone through a year of learning to fly the F-16, you know, which is several years after I had this initial experience. And that's when I realized that it's a bit more complicated than just flying a fancy jet. Like there's some in-depth tactical and technical knowledge you have to learn and the number of things you have to manage in the cockpit beyond just flying the airplane, the sensors, the situational awareness you have to have of where all the other aircraft are, how different assets integrate with what you're doing. It's very complicated. And I actually really struggled with learning all of that later on once I got to that point in my career. But I had no idea all the intricacies of it when I was like, I'm going to go be a fighter pilot.
You just thought you show up flight school, you know, it was a little competitive, right? Like you had to beat some people out, but you could do it. Yeah, it's funny.
Yeah, exactly. Like you're saying there's a chance.
Yeah, you're giving me a chance. The most important question is kind of before we get kind of more technical and talk more about flying is where did you go to school? What college did you go to?
I went to the University of St. Thomas, which is a private school in St. Paul, Minnesota.
Okay, good. I was afraid you're going to say Wisconsin. I went to Ohio State. So naturally, if you went to Wisconsin, I was just going to be like, well, I'll talk about this later. So
I wanted to go to UW-Madison, but they did not have a criminal justice degree at the time. It was like you had to be a sociology major. And turns out it would not have mattered at all, right?
It's funny.
I have used my criminal justice degree zero.
Well, it's funny. Like when you make these choices, so you made this choice where you wanted to go to school based on what you thought you wanted to do. You go to the school and you're in ROTC and you're like, well, I don't want to do that anymore. I want to do this where maybe there's a better school that you could have gone to do that if you wanted to, you know, but it all works out, right? So it just goes to show that if you're in a spot and you want to do something, you can make it happen no matter what kind of your limitations are or whatever kind of factors or setbacks you might have ahead of you. So you made it happen.
For sure. And I talk to a lot of high school students or young adults who have, you know, this big goal of they'll come up to me and be like, how do I fly for the Thunderbirds? Or like, how do I become a fighter pilot? And I think those goals are great, but I always try to emphasize to them that things are going to happen that are unexpected. New opportunities are going to come up that you don't even know exist right now. And you don't have to be married to your dream. Like it can evolve and it can change and you're going to mature and grow and priorities will shift. And that's normal and that's okay. And I really have found success now by being willing to just be open to opportunities as they come up and pivot as needed to take advantage of them.
And that's good advice for kind of anyone in any spot, whether it's aviation, whether you're going into the military or you're just doing civilian. It's like my route, I wanted to be a 121 airline pilot, but it's changed. Now I'm more 135, 91K just based on my experiences as I was building my flight time and the hours I was getting. So I naturally just went the way that kind of my career is dragging me. So I said no to the airlines and yes to other options. But same thing. I think it's important to have a goal, right? Like to have something to go strive for. But if some other opportunity comes up, don't be afraid to say yes to it.
For sure. For sure.
And that opportunity for you was becoming a fighter pilot. So talk about kind of mindset, ROTC currently. You want to be a fighter pilot. How many other people raised their hands? Was it intimidating? Like you said, like you put your hand up, everyone's be like, well, let's make sure she's actually going to do that. Like you set the record right there. So talk a little bit about that.
It was definitely intimidating. I am kind of more introverted. And at that time I was very shy, and just putting my hand up for anything in general was stressful to me. So, you know, being willing to put myself out there and being like, I do want to do this, and putting on kind of that fake it till you make it attitude of like, I'm going to like, watch me, I'm going to make this happen. That required me kind of mustering a lot of courage behind the scenes. And people had this outside perspective that I was doing really well and, you know, doing great in the ROTC program. I was probably going to get a pilot slot. I had a good chance of being a fighter pilot. Like the outside perspective is that I was a high achiever. I was doing well. I had the capacity to actually make this happen. But inside I was like, we're just going to tell everyone that and kind of hope for the best, and we'll work really hard and see what happens. So there was some self-doubt on my end for sure. And I can't remember exactly how many people put their hands up. I think in my class, not everyone wants to be a pilot. Of course, the common misconception that everyone in the Air Force flies airplanes, which is definitely not the truth. I think we had 5 or 6 people from my class of 30 something students get pilot slots. And I think that's about how many wanted them. So it wasn't especially competitive in ROTC. You had to have a decent GPA and have good physical fitness score tests and stuff to even meet the minimums to qualify. But it got more competitive once I got into pilot training, because each class was only getting anywhere from like 1 to 3 fighter aircraft is what was coming out on our drop nights, which is where you find out what airframe you're going to fly.
Yeah. So I was going to say, going from raising your hand to going to pilot training and kind of that process, what's immediately after that? Is it just you setting goals and knowing what the requirements are for you to actually kind of apply and be attractive for that kind of job? Or kind of talk about the timeline from raising your hand, I want to do this, to actually getting accepted.
Yeah. So I definitely knew what the requirements were, what things got looked at. It's all about cadet ranking, which was physical fitness test scores. Your GPA is honestly the biggest thing. And then how the cadre rank you as far as cadet leadership in the wing. And that's like the ambiguous one. And so, you know, it's a very tangible thing to work towards when you're like, okay, I need to get 100% on my PT test, my physical fitness test, my run, push-ups and sit-ups. I can set goals that are very measurable in that part of the equation. And then GPA, same thing. It's like, okay, I need to have a fairly high GPA to compete. So like, what do I need to do to make sure I'm getting A's in my classes? So I felt like those two were pretty in my control. And I did well in both of those areas. And that's probably what solidified me as competitive. And then the cadet wing leadership stuff, I struggled with that more because of the stuff I already mentioned. I didn't love putting myself out there. I didn't love being out front or having attention on me. And we look at ROTC, the opportunities for that a lot of times are like in drill, where you're going to be marching a formation and like yelling a cadence and up in front of the whole cadet wing. There's not really a lot of places where you get more like front and center and visible than that. And so that was very uncomfortable for me. So I had a hard time volunteering to do those things, but I forced myself to do it occasionally, enough where I felt like that area wasn't just like slacking. But I think I put the bulk of my efforts into academics and fitness to make sure I was really solid in those areas.
All right. So you are getting your selection. Did you feel confident going into it, or was there kind of doubt in the back of your mind? Like, I don't know if I did enough. I don't know if I was enough of a leader, or were you pretty confident?
I think to get the pilot slot initially, I was pretty confident because I knew that most classes were getting 5, 6, 7 slots like that. And I kind of knew where my peers stood, and I was like, okay, I might not be first in my class, but I'm, you know, solidly in those top few. So I'm pretty confident, but you know, I was never like, this is 100% going to happen. There was always a little bit of doubt that would creep in until my commander for the detachment called me in and handed me a set of wings, which they like will give you those to work towards. And then I was like, holy crap, this is happening. And I just remember how exciting that day was. And it was like the middle of the day on a Thursday, and I had to go to class afterwards. And I remember like walking to class and trying to call my parents, trying to call my sister, trying to call like anyone that I would normally call, and no one answered their phones.
No way.
And I was just like, I have to tell someone. I can't just go sit in my class and like have not told anyone about
this.
That's
hilarious.
I finally got a hold of one of my friends who is in Navy ROTC. And he was like, why are you calling me in the middle of a Thursday? And I was like, I have to tell someone this. But yeah, so I think that process made sense to me. I felt fairly confident. It got more stressful and more competitive once I was in pilot training, now trying to get a fighter aircraft.
When did the excitement turn into kind of like the stress of like, oh crap, I actually have to do this now?
Oh, I think when I showed up to my first base, like when I showed up to pilot training and you're, you know, you've just moved across the country. I was born and raised in Wisconsin, went to college in Minnesota, which is practically the same place. And then I was going to pilot training in Columbus, Mississippi.
A little different.
So a little bit of culture shock right there, right? I remember I went to the Walmart in Columbus when I was first getting settled in to get groceries. And I was pushing my cart out to put it away after I put my groceries in my car. And this lady came up and was like, y'all fixing to leave that buggy? And I just stared at her because I had no idea what she was. She was like asking if she could use my cart. I was so confused. But yeah, a little bit of just an adjustment there, right? And then kind of the first time just moving far away from your family. And then you're like thrust into this very curated, stressful environment. Like they intentionally are putting you under a lot of stress beyond what you naturally experience in the cockpit by being new to flying. So they're doing stand up, which is where everyone stands up and they're like, okay, you have this warning light comes on. You're at this 1,000 feet, you're on final, blah, blah, blah. You have the aircraft. Like, what are you going to do? And if you say something wrong, they're like, sit down, and they'll go around and you're just standing there at attention, hoping they don't come to you next. And then they'll be like, all right, Lieutenant Kern, you have the aircraft. You're like, oh shit. And so it's drinking from a fire hose. There's just so much information to learn. You can't learn it all at once. It just takes time to chip away at it. And they know that. It's intentionally created that way. And then you're also thrust into this group of people. My class was 25. And those people are going to be your best friends over the next year, but they're also your competition. And so you're all trying to feel each other out at first, like, oh, who here wants to fly fighters? Who here wants to do X, Y, and Z? Like, what's your background? Oh, just who here has hours? Who doesn't? All that stuff. And so there's all of that, you know, the standard parts of forming a team. You have to go through all of that in just a high stress environment. So showing up to base first day of UPT, getting briefed by our class, I don't even remember what they're called, the advisor for our class. That's when I was like, okay, like here we go. When you know you're being evaluated the second you step into the room.
Absolutely. Did you feel like you had to put on like a show or like an act, like kind of act like someone else when you got in there? Or did you feel pretty comfortable being yourself?
I definitely had to do that whole muster the courage thing to be appear confident in what I was saying. And, you know, I think I helped myself do that by putting in an insane amount of preparation and work for things. Like I would study all weekend. We had 12-hour work days where we had to be there no matter what. And so people are just studying nonstop when they're not, you know, actually doing flights. So I think I would prepare to the point where I could create fake confidence until I started to develop it through getting proficient at the actual skills. I don't feel like I had to put on too much of a facade there, but that definitely became a factor later on when I got to a fighter squadron, because the culture in a UPT class compared to an F-16 squadron, it's very different.
Yeah. It sounds like it was a little bit of like fake it till you make it at the beginning, right? Like, all right, you can do this. You can do this. Don't let people know.
For sure. And I think I felt like I was the only person doing that, but I'm sure many of my peers were doing the same thing.
As you're going through this process, did you have any, I mean, for me as a pilot, like I didn't consider myself a pilot until I was at like, kind of like my dream job where I am now. I had this imposter syndrome like the whole way up. Did you ever deal with anything like that? Like you're like, I'm not a fighter pilot. Like I'm not like, did you ever feel like, not necessarily like fake, but you're like a fraud, like you shouldn't be there?
My whole career? Like, no, but for real, I mean, imposter syndrome is one of the things I talk about in the keynote speeches that I do now, because it was such huge part of my career all the way through, even into the Thunderbirds. It just, the way you frame it changes, right? Like when I first started going through pilot training, maybe when I first got my wings, me telling people that I was a pilot felt very fake because I had just learned to fly. I hadn't done anything with it. And then you get to the end of F-16 training and now you're like, I'm a fighter pilot. Now that feels like I can't say that. I can say I'm a pilot now, but I can't say I'm a fighter pilot. And then you get to the Thunderbirds and you have stuff like, oh, I can fly the jet at this level, but I'm actually a fraud because I'm not good at Thunderbirding. I'm not good at the like public persona side of it. And it's exhausting to me. And sometimes I don't want to take pictures of people and sign autographs. So you feel like you're fake in that regard, whatever it is, there's always something. So yeah, to answer your question, that was a huge factor pretty much throughout my entire career. I just got better at dealing with it and recognizing it. And I think now it's even a thing moving from being an active duty military pilot to running a business and being a speaker and an author. I'm like, who am I that people want to read my stuff right. and listen to me talk?
No
like,
one wants to listen to me talk
yeah. for that. So it's a natural human thing that everyone struggles with.
Yeah. And it's crazy. Like you said, everyone struggles with it. When you're in the moment, you almost feel like you're alone in that. But like you said, I guarantee you, in your initial training, you were not alone at all. Everyone walked into that room like, all right, pretend to be confident. Yeah. You can do this.
Well, I think if you're going into something that's like so new and it's going to require so much work and new knowledge and new skills, you're not showing up day one with those. And so if you like genuinely walk in day one very confident, that's bad, right? Like that's your ego, that's arrogance. And that's actually going to hold you back from doing well in the program.
And you're probably a target too at that point. You're probably like a target by the people in charge, be like, we're going to humble this person real quick, you know?
100%. Yeah. People got weeded out of training if they couldn't get over that. They would kind of be deemed as, I think the phrase they would put in their grade sheets is like, does not take instruction well. And you could get washed out of the program for that if it continued to be a problem.
I mean, that's dangerous, right? It's a hazardous mentality. Yeah. So if you find really close in court encounters with someone, you want to make sure that they can listen to you and like you're talking to them and you know that you can trust each other. If there's no trust, then you can't fly with each other.
Oh, absolutely. We could do a whole episode on just trust and the development of those team dynamics, especially with flying close formation. But yeah, even in the most basic course of just pilot training, that mentality starts to get created where, hey, we learn from our mistakes. We fess up to them. We have like an open mindset where we take feedback and we learn from it. And if you can't do that, you won't last.
Looking back in your training, do you think there was an overall toughest moment? Or do you think it's kind of like, you know, like it's kind of like math going through like school, like you build on everything. You go from algebra, you go to algebra two, like you kind of just build and you get better and you get better and you get better. Do you think it was more like that? Like it was like step by step by step, it prepared you for the next step? Or was there just like one moment or a couple moments where it was like, man, this sucks. I can't do this. Outside of like the fraud or the imposter syndrome mentality.
Yeah, a couple of times. So I think I went through IFS, which is initial flight screening. I think they've changed the name now, but it's kind of like this month-long program. It was out in Pueblo, Colorado. We were flying the DA-20. So flying super slow, tiny little airplane. That's the first thing I ever soloed. I think we're cruising around like 80 knots. And that program, well, it's the easiest aircraft I've ever flown in my entire career. When you line them all up, that was the hardest for me because I didn't come from a technical background, right? Criminal justice degree here. I didn't understand anything. Like we're having classes on how these aircraft work, which are very simple airplanes. And I don't understand how an oil system works. I wasn't a car person. Like I don't understand how the electrical system works and the generators and the battery. And like a lot of my peers were electrical engineers or aeronautical engineers. And so they were like, oh, this is easy. Like, I don't even have to study this stuff. I just have to read it once. And I'm like, okay, makes sense. And meanwhile, I'm like, what's the difference between AC and DC? Like what? none of that was familiar to me. And so I had to catch up to everyone in that. And then same thing with flying, I had no hours. So everything from learning about airspace to radio calls to how taxiways and runways are labeled, like all of that was new. And so there was just so much to learn that I definitely had some late nights there where I would study till midnight, knowing I had to wake up at 5 a.m. and I would just go to bed and not be able to sleep because I was so stressed and did not feel ready. And I eventually caught up to everyone else. And I remember leaving that program and going around and getting my like out processing checklist signed off by all the instructors. And my flight commander was like, congratulations. And you did really well. And I was like, what? I felt like I was just barely surviving, about to get washed out at any point, that entire program. But I think it's kind of designed that way. So that month-long program, I felt like, oh man, I might be in over my head. And not just because of like general imposter syndrome, but just the amount of stuff I needed to learn. It was just so much. And then pilot training itself, I actually really enjoyed. I feel like I figured out a really good system for time management and balancing a little bit of time to have fun on the weekends with studying and being prepared for flights. And I was just good at managing the stress level generally. And so I did pretty well consistently. I did bust one check ride.
Oh no.
And
what happened?
Yeah. Yeah. Which in pilot training, it's funny because that doesn't even like go on your record. It's not like you go look and the FAA knows. It's just part of this formal training program. And I would say most people hooked or busted a check ride at some point. And for me, it was the dumbest thing. It was actually for pubs.
Oh, really?
And we had like paper publications that our examiners would check. And so we would like go through and check them before against the master publication that Stanovel had to make sure they were good for our check ride. And I did that and I like went page by page checking all my stuff. So I felt very ready for the flight and for that, which almost was like just this kind of formality as far as the, from the most examiner's point of view. Turns out there had been this memo for some update that they had put in the front of this publication. I can't remember all the specifics, but then there was like another update that came out that was like, hey, that memo is no longer accurate. It needs to be removed. And mine had it in the front and the master one didn't. And I didn't catch it because it was like before the main cover page. And so he like opens the first page of my pubs and he was like, this is outdated.
You failed.
And this is like, this is before I even flew. And so I like went and did the flight and actually the flight itself went great. And then we land and he's like, well, it's going to be a hook. Like you're going to have to see this again. And I thought he was kidding at first because the flight had gone so well. And actually a lot of the other instructors were like, I can't believe he busted you for that. It should have just been a downgrade. Like, I think they made an example of me essentially because they wanted to emphasize like, this is not a joke. Like we're take this seriously. And turns out it didn't matter. It did fine. I redid the check ride and did great the next time. But that was like a huge morale blow to me because I had been doing so well in the program. And all of a sudden I was like, wait, what? You're serious.
Yeah. And I'm guessing holy, you thought like your kind crap of dreams are crashing down in front of you. It's like, well, there goes fighter pilot. I failed. Like, why would they select me now?
Of course. Of course. Like you don't have perspective at the time that it might not be as big of a deal. And so I thought like this one piece of paper just cost me this thing I've worked towards for years at this point. I've put in thousands of hours of work and like dedication to get here and that's it. Yeah. So that was for sure a rough couple days. And then, you know, I moved on and continued to do well in the program and ended up getting, my class of 25 got two fighter aircraft.
Oh, damn.
And I got one of the two. Oh, my God. So, well, I mean, the odds were not in my favor.
Yeah. And it brings up a good question. What a lot of pilots, I mean, even just like civilian pilots, they always preach, have a backup plan. You don't know what's going to happen, right? Did you have a backup plan? You mentioned earlier in the podcast, like I was fighter jets or nothing. Like I didn't really want to do it. But like, what were you going to do if you didn't get it? I mean, obviously you take the slot that you can, right? You're not going to be like, all right, well, I'll just go do whatever now. I'm going to go hang out at the Air Force Academy or whatever you do next. What was your plan?
Yeah. So I knew, I think I set the goal as, you know, fighter jets are bust because that can be very motivating. It can be like a huge driving factor if you're like, I don't have a plan B. But realistically, I have a plan B because the Air Force just spent $1 million to train me. You can't just leave. Like they're going to give you an airframe and you're going to go fly it no matter what it is. And so, you know, I put a lot of thought into my dream sheet. I put F-16s and then A-10s and then all the other fighter aircraft. I think I put B-1s and B-2s after that and then C-17s. And I knew by the time I got that far down the list, I knew I was doing well. So I was going to get at least one of those. Like it might not be a fighter aircraft, but I wasn't going to end up in something that was like 10th on my list, unless the Air Force completely changed what airframes were available compared to what I'd seen come out of other classes. So I kind of had prepared myself to be okay flying bombers and okay flying C-17s, because that's a really cool airplane with a cool mission. And so I was like, all right, I will be happy with any of these, but I still really, really want fighter jets.
Please, please, please. Is there like an alternate like universe where you could have seen yourself like in a C-17, or like what other aircraft would have been like kind of like you could envision having a good career and enjoying your time?
Oh, totally. I mean, I know so many people in all the different airframes. I think a lot of my friends fly C-17s, and that's such a cool airplane, and it has all the, you know, the HUD, the heads up display, the missions that they do, the places that they go. I mean, if you've seen one do like a short field landing and takeoff, it's crazy impressive. I could have easily, I think you adapt to whatever community you end up in. And so it's hard to see it when you're so used to a different one. But I've been told by many pilots in different airframes who moved between communities, they're like, look, once you get settled in, that's your family. Like you take on all the attributes of that community and you embrace it. And most people don't spend their career miserable wishing they were flying something else.
Yeah. Let's take a break from today's episode and hear from our sponsor, RAA. If you're like me, you might wonder, am I saving enough for the financial future I want flying? That's when I check with RAA's free retirement paycheck calculator, and you'll want to as well. Based on a few simple financial factors, I get an instant snapshot of how much I could expect to receive each month in retirement. And if I'm falling short of my goals, adjustments I can make to get my saving strategy back on track. It's quick, easy, and free. Try it today at raa.com/pilot-to-pilot. And now back to today's episode. When you, I guess looking from the outside, looking in, you mentioned kind of like these different families, like everyone's different, like they kind of all have their personality types. And I'm sure everyone kind of judges them based on what they do. Is it kind of like a frat mentality? Like it's like, oh, these are like the all different kind of frats and you guys all just kind of hang out with yourselves. Is there a lot of like intertwined, like hanging out with other squadrons? I'm guessing on deployments, it might be different, but just kind of in general.
Yeah. So I think it's like a friendly rivalry between different airframes. We all give each other a little bit of crap, right? Like you say, oh, well, you know, the Eagles only do air to air. Like you can't even say the word bomb because they don't drop bombs, or like there's all these different little sayings, between them. You know, people call F-16 lawn darts because we only have one engine. There's just like all that kind of stuff. But realistically, when everyone's brought together for an actual deployment or a big exercise, like a large force exercise, everyone works together extremely well. And everyone knows what each other's strengths and weaknesses are and how you fill those gaps to fit this puzzle together to be the most effective team. And so like, that's all fun and games. But when stuff is actually going down, all of that's cast aside. And you like walk into a mission planning cell the day before with all these people you've never met before, all different airframes, but we have kind of a common structure and a common acceptance of how things will run to get the mission planned. And things generally go pretty smoothly and everyone knows what they're supposed to do and fulfills their role. It's pretty cool to see.
As you kind of mentioned this earlier, but it was very competitive, right? Coming up through all your ranks of training. Cause I mean, you all want to do well, you all want to make sure your friend does well, but at the end of the day, it's number one, number two, number three, number four. Like there's only so many slots that you can get. How is there, or is there a line, like when you get to like compete between number one and number two, or two versus three, is there a line where you just like stop helping other people and you're like, well, they suck, this like sucks to suck, you know, like I got to look out for myself? Or is it really encouraged to make sure like you put your best foot forward, you make sure everyone's doing the best that they can possibly do. And if someone is just better than you, they're better than you. And you just have to accept that.
Yeah, I think it's more the latter. People generally, from what I saw, by the time you get to that last month or so of the program where you have a pretty solid idea of where people are falling, because you don't see the sheet that ranks everyone, but you know how people have done their check rides, you know how their flights are going day to day. And so you have this idea of where you generally fall. You might not be 100% confident, but you generally know who your competition is. And with the exception of one person ever in my class that I can remember, everyone was very supportive. Like you would joke with each other a little bit, but you would sit down and study together. You would quiz each other on things. You would answer questions for each other. So it was a pretty supportive environment. And I'm still friends with a lot of those people.
minus one person.
Yeah. And I say that because I get asked about that a lot. So I'll commonly get the question about like gender, right? And because like in my pilot training class, I was the only woman in the class of 25. And 99% of the time that was not a factor. Like no one cared. I was like one of the guys. I was good friends with all of them. No, I wasn't treated any different. There was one person in my class right at the very end, right before our last check rides. And we were actually studying together. I think we had like all made a common study guide and we were sitting at a table and he was like, I don't even know why I'm wasting my time because they're going to select you for a fighter aircraft just to check the diversity box. He like said that verbatim to my face. And I was just like, what? Like, I have never had anyone say that to me since. Maybe some trolls on the internet, but they don't count. And I was just like so shocked and taken aback because I had hung out with this person for the last year and studied together. And but once I, you know, went home that night and thought about it and I had my last check ride coming up and we had someone in our class that just was crushing it. And he was clearly first. And then it was between me and this person that had made that remark for the second spot. One of us was going to be second. One of us was going to be third. And looking at previous classes, a lot of classes were getting anywhere from 1 to 3 fighter aircraft. So being in that second spot was like really important. It meant a lot. It could be the determining factor. And it ended up being the determining factor because we only got 2 for my class. And so I went home after that remark and I was like, I am going to have the best check ride of my life. Like this next check ride, I'm going in fully prepared. And I've been flying, you know, the T-38 for that point, almost 6 or 7 months. So I felt fairly comfortable in it because you're just flying so much. So I was confident in my knowledge at that point. I was confident in my ability to fly the airplane to do what we needed to do for that check ride. And I ended up having my best check ride of the entire program. And it actually acted as like a motivation for me. And then he did fine on his, but not as good. And so when he landed and told us how he had done, he actually said something like he was resigned to the fact that he was going to be third in the class.
You're just like,
yeah. And I was like, I don't want to be a jerk, but sucks damn, that felt good.
Yeah, absolutely.
I was like, what a jerk thing to say. Yeah. I mean, there is that underlying competition between all of us for obvious reasons, but I think that's one thing to acknowledge it and still be a good person and help the people around you. And then to just I think he was like letting his own self-doubt like remove the filter between his brain and his mouth for a second and whatever. But that comment I won't ever forget because it was just so blatant. I haven't had anything in my career since that has been quite so did anyone else just hear that? Yeah, was that like, just said?
Did you say to me? Like you're talking to someone behind me? Like what's happening right now?
It was just so uncomfortable and awkward. But you know, hey, it worked out in the end.
Well, it's kind of like a big thing too, because you were faced with a moment where you could have gone like 1 or 2 ways. You know, you could have, I mean, I don't know how you actually reacted in the moment, but like you can either kind of take it, walk away and just deal with it on your own, or you can make a big deal about it and bring attention to it. And who knows if that could eventually hurt you based on how you react to that situation. Could have been negative, you know, you punch him in the face, all that kind of stuff. Like it looks bad on you, right? There's a lot of emotions when they're coming and attacking you like that. So you were faced with a decision to make and how you actually handle that, which is essentially can lead to how you handle adversity in any situation. So you handled it great. You got what you wanted to do and you made it happen, but that was definitely a choice that you had to make.
Yeah, I don't think in the moment I was so caught off guard. I think I was just like, I don't think that's how it works. I think I said something like that. And then I just like moved on with my day. But it definitely bothered me.
Yeah, as it should for sure. You're talking about planes. What, and you mentioned the DA-20 kind of the beginning was one of the more difficult moments for you in your training, but actual flying of an airplane, the DA-20 is very simple. And I'm guessing you picked on it pretty quickly as you're moving up. What was, so DA-20 and what came after the DA-20? I'm guessing you went from going very, very slow to really fast, very fast.
Yeah. So it was still what I always say is baby steps, but it's not really a baby step from a DA-20 to a T-6, where you cruise around at 300 knots. And you can pull 6 Gs, you know, fully aerobatic. You're doing everything from flying instrument approaches to flying formation and formation, you know, roles and all the stuff. So it's quite the leap, but the program's built for that. Like you're stepping into this formal training program that is intentionally crafted by the Air Force to take brand new students to a specific level of proficiency. So they've put a lot of time and effort and money into trying to make it doable, like challenging, but doable. And so I would always just remind myself of that. Like, this is not impossible. It's crafted so people can succeed in it. And so I think the T-6 actually is a fairly easy airplane to fly. It's very user-friendly. And so I remember just having a ton of fun learning to fly that airplane. I struggled with landings for a while. I remember one of my instructors, her husband was a F-22 pilot at the time, and she was still teaching in the T-6. She's like, I was telling my husband about you because most of the students, they will flare high. And so I'm always like, no, keep driving. Like, don't flare yet. She's like, you're the opposite. You just drive at the runway until I'm like, oh God, flare. And I was like, I don't know. Like, cause I had nothing to compare it to, right? Besides the DA-20. And so I was like, oh, I don't know. So maybe that was an inkling of my ability to override my own self-preservation that would come in handy flying for the Thunderbirds. But yeah, that was funny. So it took a while to develop that sight picture and that feel for just like what the aircraft should look like landing, where your aim point should be, when you should time your shifts and all of that. And I think me dabbling in general aviation just a tiny bit now after flying the F-16 for so long, I'm struggling with that again because it's so different, you know? So I think no matter what your experience level is, that always is a little bit of a sticking point till you get familiar with that specific aircraft.
Definitely. I would totally agree. Yeah. You go from a F-16 to 737, I'm guessing it'd be a little bit different, you know, how you fly an airplane. You're not going to do a bear rolls anymore.
Higher.
Yeah. Yeah. So your time, so you're going through training. You're doing well. Like you said, like maybe you didn't feel that at the time, but they said you're doing well. Did Thunderbirds ever like pique your interest? Was it like a hidden goal in your back of your head that you're like, that's what I'm actually going for? Kind of how does that play out? How does one either get selected or even think about going down that route?
Yes. So kind of yes and kind of no to your question. So Thunderbirds would come up in conversations periodically, not so much in pilot training because that's just like so far removed from that. But once you're flying the F-16, you know, various points in your assignments, either just among your peers, someone old, like in your squadron that's a few years older will be applying. So everyone will be talking about it. Or I had a wing commander when I was at my first assignment in Japan. The Air Force had actually put out a directive like, we do not have any like women applying for this. Why is this a thing? Like, encourage the female pilots at your base to at least put their name in the hat to compete. And I was not old enough at that point. To even apply, did not have enough hours yet. But my wing commander, I think in my like out processing interview with him, like doing an interview before I was about to move on to my next base. And he asked me if it was something I was interested in. And I honestly, I was like, I don't even know. Like I'm not experienced enough yet. I don't even know. But it was always one of those things that intrigued me a little bit. Like I would always, my ears would perk up when I would hear a conversation about it and I'd kind of be listening in, you know, like when people would apply in my squadron, I would always ask them a bunch of questions about what it was like. And so I think the interest was there, but honestly, I had a lot of doubt around whether or not I was good enough to even consider applying to the team. And the idea of applying was really scary because, you know, you're like, you're analyzed at an extreme level to get hired with the Thunderbirds. And so I don't think I had the confidence yet to set it as a goal. I wasn't ready to raise my hand and tell everyone, like, I want to fly for the Thunderbird someday, like I had done back in ROTC with just flying in general. So I didn't tell anyone that it was a goal, and I didn't really set it as a goal for myself. And then I got to my second F-16 squadron. So I've been flying the jet for about 7 years at that point, and I was in Texas, and my assignment there was about to be done. I'd been there for 3 years. And during that assignment, I went through a really big period of growth just as a pilot and just as a person. I deployed for the first time. I became an instructor pilot. I got to spend a summer in Poland teaching and flying in their F-16s, like teaching Polish pilots to fly. And all of those things were really stressful and uncomfortable, but I they were huge confidence boosts once you make it to the other side, right? And you learn a ton, and it just develops your skills, your confidence, your competence, all of that. And I was about to move to New Mexico for my next base to be an instructor at the F-16 schoolhouse teaching brand new F-16 pilots. And I saw this email from the Thunderbirds, and it was actually not the first email. It was like the last one being like, last call for applications.
Like, wait, where are the last four emails?
Well, they come from the Air Force Personnel Center, and they like the from part in the email and like the subject, a lot of it looks the same for all of them. And there'll be emails about all different career opportunities. It'll be like, oh, go be an executive officer at this base and go to do a 180 day thing in Korea or whatever. And I just knew I wasn't really interested in doing any of that stuff at that point. So I will be very honest. I just deleted them with never reading them.
You were like this close to not even getting the chance to apply.
Oh, totally. Yeah. And I don't know what was going on that day that I actually opened the email. And not only that, I was like, oh, Thunderbirds. And I scrolled down and I read the requirements and I realized that I met all of them. And I was actually quite a bit beyond the minimums for most of them. And I kind of had this moment where I just sat there and I was like, I could apply to this. Like, and so I went to my boss, who was just a really great commander. And I had dropped the ball at this point for wanting to be a Thunderbird pilot. Like, I'm about to move in 3 months to this new base. They're already expecting me. They're already counting me in their manning for the instructors they're going to have. And they're, of course, short people like every squadron is. And I had never told my commander that it was a goal. And usually you do like every 6 months or so, you'll sit down with your commander and talk about career goals and like they'll figure out ways to help you achieve them. I never, ever brought this up. And so I go to his office and I'm like, so sir, like I saw this email. What do you think about this? And he could have completely changed my future with that one conversation one way or the other. He could have very rightfully been like, sorry, Mace, we should have planned for this a while ago. Like, Holloman's already expecting you. We've already kind of mapped this out, your next assignment. You should apply next year. And I would have been like, okay. And I would have never pushed back. I would have been like, yep, totally makes sense. And I would have gone off to New Mexico and who knows what would have happened. But instead, he was just an awesome mentor. And he kind of like sat there for a second. He was like, do you want to apply? And I was like, I think so. And then he said, I think you would be an incredible Thunderbird pilot. And like getting that vote of confidence from someone I really respected, and then him being willing to take the time to help me get this application done that was due like the following week, like get letters of recommendations from generals and all this stuff. He made phone calls. Yeah. He sent emails on my behalf. Like him willing to do that for me was huge. And that was what allowed me to even get an application in to be considered. And I ended up getting hired after, you know, another 6 or 7 months later of multiple interviews and in-person interviews and all that kind of stuff. And so I actually texted him, I think last year, just like, hey, I don't know if you ever realized how big of a deal this was. But like, I'm so grateful that you were willing to take the time and be supportive and help me make that happen. So I think it's just a cool example of when you find yourself in a role where you can do that for someone, just those a few hours out of your day or your week can change someone's life.
Yeah, and it just goes to show how important a mentor is too, right? Like, or maybe not even a mentor, but just someone that's in a position of power or someone that you respect that has the opportunity to guide you and kind of see who you are. Absolutely. And know what your limitations are, or what you can actually do, and believe in you. Because someone else believing in you will give you the most confidence in the world, right? You're probably like jazzed up, ready to 100%. Go. Like, Thunderbirds, here we come. Let's go.
It definitely gave me a confidence boost. Yeah. Because I was still very much feeling like I'm feeling drawn that I should go do this. Like, I'm excited about it. I think I should at least try, but I'm also terrified.
So what comes next? So you mentioned like 6 months of interviews, a bunch of just like Skype interviews, in-person interviews, just trying to get to know who you are, just trying to make sure you can kind of be a good person. Cause you know, airline interviews, it's usually just like everyone can fly a plane, but they want to make sure that they're not going to want to kill you for a 3 day period. Right. Is it kind of the same, or is it more technical? Got to know your stuff way above kind of any other normal situation.
We got to make sure we're not going to want to kill you, but on steroids, right? Because we were on the road 240 days a year together.
240?
Yeah.
That's crazy.
So it's, you see these people way more than you see your family, and you're in a high stress environment and you're flying, you know, feet away from each other at extreme speeds, close to the ground, that person could kill you. Like, not exaggerating at all, right? If they make a mistake, it could have catastrophic results. So, of course, there is a baseline level of flying required. Most, I won't say a lot of fighter pilots who are already at that experience level can meet that baseline flying. Then you get to the point of, do they have the ability to do the specific maneuvers that we want them to do in a very uncomfortable environment? And so I'm not talking just like the stick and rudder skills, but kind of like the mental fortitude to be in situations where you feel like you're in danger, because that's like a real thing. We always joke that during training season, when you're new to the team, half the battle is just like killing your inherent survival instinct, because your body wants you to get away from that other airplane. Your body doesn't want to be upside down 100 feet above the ground. It doesn't want to be doing like those head-on chicken passes, the posing passes that we did as solos. It's so uncomfortable at first. And some people just can't get over the fear of being in that. And so they will never get to meet to the point where they meet standards. That's been a struggle for a few people. But honestly, the biggest thing is team dynamics, which you alluded to. It's, you know, does this person have a personality where we can not only tolerate them, but actually enjoy being on a team with them? Can they do the public facing part of the job? Will they be good with talking to little kids, with people with special needs? Will they be good on camera interviews? Like, you cannot just be a really good fighter pilot, but have a really low EQ and suck at talking to people. Like, that just doesn't work with the Thunderbirds. And so it's really like this whole person concept that they're looking at. And then it gets even more complicated because about half of the team comes from a non F-16 background. So the Thunderbirds are flying F-16s, but, you know, I flew Vipers my whole career, but my opposing solo was an F-22 pilot. Our director of operations was an A-10 pilot. One of the wingmen right now was an F-15 pilot. And so you have to keep, those people will go through a transition course to learn to fly the F-16, but it's short. It's like 6 weeks long or something like that. So they're learning, they're not learning the tactical stuff. It's very basic knowledge. So you need people in the formation who have been in Vipers their whole career. So you have that depth of knowledge when you're on a 5-hour cross country and someone gets some weird light or some weird smell in their cockpit or some weird buffet on the air. Like, you just can't have a person who has, you know, 100 hours in the jet being the expert there. You need someone who has 1,000 hours or 2,000 hours. So that becomes part of the equation. And then where will you put them in the formation? The two solos, which I was one of, we would sometimes fly places by ourselves or we would be airborne by ourselves. So one of those people should probably be an F-16 background person. And there's just all of these puzzle pieces. And so the hiring process is actually really complex and difficult. It's hard to find the right people for the right spots. And sometimes you really, really love someone that applied. You want to be on the team with them. And you're like, I would love to spend time with this person. They're so much fun. They're clear, like, their motivation to be on the team is really pure and they would be great. But their aircraft background doesn't fit into the puzzle. And so they wouldn't get hired. And sometimes that sucked. And so it's a complex process.
You know, this is like kind of like the highest of high, right? Like Thunderbird pilots. It's like, there's not much going up for that, right? In the Air Force, like, that's like creme de la crop. Like what a lot of people strive to be and kind of look up to and what they want to do, right?
Yeah, you kind of have two camps, I think. So from the public's perspective, I think that's very true. From a pilot's perspective, about the time you hit enough experience to apply to the Thunderbirds, you're also hitting the experience level to apply to test school or to weapons school, which is the Air Force's equivalent of Top Gun. And so I think those three things, the Thunderbirds, test pilot school, weapons school, are like the high-end programs that people go through. And I wouldn't say the Thunderbird pilots are better than the weapons school graduates. They're just two different skill sets, right? Like, they're the best tacticians. They're the people that will craft tactics for the operational squadrons that are our bread and butter of the entire fighter pilot community. We're really good at flying aerobatics and with precision and like on a knife's edge. And a lot of those guys would hate to do the flying that we're doing. And some of us would hate to do the stuff that they're doing. And so I think I always want to make sure people understand that not everyone wants to be a Thunderbird pilot. It's like a specific goal that a small portion of the fighter pilot community has, and it has its place, but there's other really cool, high accomplished aviation programs in the Air Force that people go through.
When you set a goal like that, you know, something maybe you look up to for so long, or even we can just say being a fighter pilot, when you set a goal and you achieve that goal, you know, you put so much hope, you looked forward to it for so long. Did it meet all of your crazy expectations that you had for that? Was there any kind of letdown when you got there and you're like, I mean, this isn't like kind of what I thought I was going to be? Or was it just like, did it meet everything you ever thought that it was going to be?
Oh, no, there was definitely a letdown because what the appeal was for me was flying these high performance aircraft. I loved roller coasters. I was a thrill seeker. I like wanted to fly upside down. I wanted to fly fast. You get to do that, but that's just like a tiny little piece of the whole puzzle. And I say it was a letdown. I think it was more just of a shock of how much work goes on besides that, right? Like you are working, my first squadron in Japan, we were working 12 to 15 hour days, Monday through Friday. And then we would come in on the weekends to mission plan for our mission on Monday. And it was just like the most intense operations tempo and grind I'd ever been a part of. And the tactical amount of knowledge that you needed to learn was just, it felt like never ending. Like you would feel like you got your arms around one concept and then there were 20 more that you needed to dig into. And all of that is happening. And it just feels like there's so much more to it than you imagine. It is not all fun and games. It's not glamorous. It's long days. It's wearing an anti-exposure suit, spending hours and hours in the cockpit, trying to figure out how to go to the bathroom in an anti-exposure suit and like trying to eat your lunch in the cockpit and missing birthdays and being sleep deprived. And it's not as glamorous as Hollywood makes it seem. And then all pilots have extra duties too, that people don't really even talk about. We all have some sort of role in the squadron that's not related to the flying missions that we're doing, like the chief of scheduling or standardization and evaluation, or the person that gets the unit ready for deployments, or like there's an endless list. And so you fly these flights, you spend hours debriefing them. You've been up since 5 a.m. and you're like, oh, okay, cool. I've been at work for 12 hours. I would love to just go home at this point. And then you go open your email and there's all of this administrative stuff that you have to take care of. And then I was just playing whack-a-mole trying to stay on top of that because it's like secondary to the flying that you're doing. So it's a hard career. It is not easy. It's a lot. It's a lot of work. But there's some absolutely incredible things that you get to do.
As you're looking back, well, I guess actually I'll say this. I remember when it was like the 2020 time, you guys were like flying to cities, doing flyovers and flying back. I didn't realize that was like all in one day. Like you'd like go fly to Chicago or Milwaukee and you fly straight back. Like there was no stopping, going to the bathroom. It was just in, out. Like those were long days. That wasn't just like a 1 hour flight, land, get some food, hang out for a couple of days. That's intense.
Yes. So the America Strong flyovers is what those were called. And there were two of those flights. All of those flights were very challenging. There were two of them, the one over Colorado that we did, and then the one up the entire Eastern seaboard where we took off from Pensacola with the Blue Angels, flew low level over Atlanta, Baltimore, DC, New York City, Boston. And I mean, that's a longish to do that all the way and then come back to Pensacola in one flight is a long flight in an airliner. Now you're in a single seat F-16 with crappy autopilot and you're flying close formation for hundreds of miles at 500 to 1,000 feet off the ground. The hardest flight I ever flew. It was almost 8 hours. We were exhausted. We had to air refuel. Like I can't even remember how many times we had the logistical lift of that flight was insane as well, because we have the F-18s with us. They have a different tanker than we have. So we have multiple tanker tracks above all of these places. We're flying over places like the Hudson River, over the Brooklyn Bridge, past the Statue of Liberty. Mind you, this is a time when no one else was flying. So there wasn't a lot of air traffic. So we flew, you know, at 500 to 1,000 feet over the international airport in Atlanta, with smoke on right past the tower in formation, which that would never happen at any other time, right? We did the same thing in Denver, same thing at LaGuardia, like just surreal, crazy pinch me moments when you think about it from a pilot's perspective. But man, the logistical lift that went into those flights, I don't think people realize that in our squadron, there's 130 people, 12 of those are officers, only 8 of those are pilots. And for those flights, our biggest concern was general aviation traffic, like random person who had been cooped up during the pandemic and was going to go take, you know, their Cessna off of an uncontrolled field, not be talking to anyone. And we're coming through with 14 fighter aircraft, 12 of which are in close formation with each other at 400 knots, right? Like that could ruin everyone's day. And no one's expecting us if they haven't happened to see something on the news about it. So our mitigation for that was to map out our flight path and call every single airport that was near that flight path. So I'm calling like the tiniest little airport that I could find one phone number for in the middle of nowhere, Colorado, that's between like Pueblo and Denver or whatever. And same thing on the East Coast. I'm like, look, calling and, you know, Bob answers. And I'm like, hey, this is Major Kern from the Thunderbirds. And then they're like, what? And I'm like, yeah, I'm one of the Thunderbird pilots. Yeah. He's like, hi. And then I'd be like, look, so we're doing this. We're coming through at this time. Like, we need to make sure no one is taking off and landing from your airfield from this window to this window. Can you like let your people, can you post signs like however, but I mean, we put NOTAMs out, but not all of those people read them. Let's be honest. And so there are no extra admin people that do those kind of tasks. So it's literally us, the Thunderbird pilots, everyone other than probably Thunderbird one, the boss had other stuff to worry about. We are just calling like 100 different airfields and giving the same spiel over and over and over, and on my personal cell phone. And like a year later, one of those guys called me randomly asking about some airshow tickets or something. I was like,
no
what?
Way.
You can't call me. This is so weird.
I can't get you tickets. Like, what do you think I am? Like, oh, that's funny. That's bad. That's really bad. I was going to ask, so that sounds one exhausting, let alone flying. Like that was probably exhausting in itself leading up to that, making all those phone calls. But when did you realize that that mission, like I'm sure when they first kind of said what you're going to do, you're like, oh, that's really cool. Like, that's going to be awesome. When did it set in, like the work, the flying, like how long and how kind of bad of a day it was going to be for you guys?
Yeah, I think the logistical stuff were like, okay, I mean, this makes sense. This is a lot, but we'll hack away at it. The flying was a bit of a like wake up call. Our first long one we did was the Colorado one because we took off from Vegas. We air refueled near Colorado Springs. We held, and then we did the flyover for the Air Force Academy graduation. So hello, there's a lot of like precision timing that goes into that. I mean, I'm sure you've seen the pictures with the hat toss, and we have to be flying over as those hats they threw up are still airborne. So it's a very small window that we have to be on. Our time on target has to be precise. So that itself would be a mission, like a full day type thing normally. And then we drop down low level and we fly over Denver, and we had mapped our route of flight based on hospitals because the whole premise behind this was to help encourage and inspire, you know, patients who could see us out the window, but really the healthcare workers, like that was our focus. So we mapped out like 42 hospitals or something like that. And this wasn't just a straight shot, like from south to north along the Front Range in Colorado. This was us doing like 270s around a hospital and then going up and doing a 360 around a different one and then heading back the other way and making like this big 90 degree turn. All of that, we are flying 3 feet from each other, 500 to 1,000 feet above the ground. And that was a bad weather day. The ceiling was, I think, between 2,000 and 3,000 feet. You have the Front Range right there, which is like the mountains disappear into the clouds. Those are tall, right? And it was snowing. And then we had to air refuel several times in our tankers. The weather was socked in from like 3,000 feet to 20 something thousand feet. So our tankers were in the weather. And so I have never been so spatially disoriented in my life as staring at an aircraft next to me flying formation, doing all these turns that you can't predict because you can't memorize them all in advance because there's just so many. And then climbing still in close formation through the weather, still looking at the jet next to you. Now you're in the inside of a ping pong ball and you feel like you're in a turn. And then you look down and you're actually straight and level, or vice versa. You feel straight and level and you look down and you're in like a 45 degree turn. You're like, oh my gosh, I'm like, my body's about to just like leave this formation. You are just like fighting so hard to just focus on the wingtip of the aircraft next to you. And I don't know if you've ever been spatially D'd, but woof, it is the most uncomfortable, scary sensation. And then you finally find this behemoth of a tanker, right? That you like slowly rejoin on in the clouds. And now you have to air refuel, which in itself is challenging in clear air. And it's very easy to get spatially disoriented on the boom of a tanker as well. And so you have to do all that. And then you got to descend back through the weather and fly some more low level over hospitals. And it was, I don't know if you've done any endurance sports where it becomes like this mental game. If you've ever like run a marathon or something like that, where it's all this mental game of just talking yourself like, okay, you can do this for 30 more seconds. Okay, you can do this for another minute. Okay, you can do this for one more mile. That was where I was at. Because my arm had gone numb, my neck was cramping. It was crazy. Like it was so much harder than any of us had imagined. And I think we landed and we were all like, we might need to pare back our flight routes a little bit. That was a lot. And I hate to complain about it because what a cool thing to be a part of. Like that's written in the history books for the Thunderbird team, right? Like that'll probably never, I hope that never happens again. And we had such a cool positive impact on so many people. The feedback we got, the phone calls, the emails that we got, I mean, they were so touching. Like they would make us tear up reading them because it was like such a hard time for so many people. And it was such a beacon of hope for so many, but I am not going to sugarcoat it. It was not fun flying in the cockpit.
I think it's interesting to know because just as like someone, a pilot that flies professionally that just sees it, it's like, oh, it's cool. The Thunderbirds are out, but like, I don't think about anything else like that. Like, I'm just thinking about you guys flying low level. We think about seeing you and then you're gone. And then you're on to the next thing. It's like, oh, cool. Like, they're probably going to go land and eat some food and go to their next place. Like, I don't think about air refueling in the soup or being like 2 feet away from another plane in the clouds. Like, you don't think about that at all.
No. And the COVID flyovers were such an extreme example. Like, some air show sites are challenging, but nothing like that. It's such a much more controlled environment. We're in a TFR. Our show routine is the same pretty much every time. You know what to expect. You know exactly how long you're going to be in a formation. I mean, I would fly Delta formation for like 12 minutes during a high show, and I'm doing it for hours during the COVID flyovers. And so it was such a different ballgame.
Looking back on your career, I know we're kind of running out of time here, but looking back on your career, two questions. What was the most rewarding part of your whole career? Could even just be beginning of the training, like getting the pilot wings to start out with versus the biggest adversity you had to face?
Oh, it's hard to narrow both of those down to one thing. I have the moments I'll never forget, like finding out that I got F-16s out of pilot training. There was so much leading up to that and so much work and so much dreaming and hoping and like trying to figure out how to be competitive. I will never forget that. That's for sure. Finding out I made the Thunderbirds when I got that phone call was a similar type of feeling. I think the two most rewarding things though, employing weapons in combat in like a danger close situation where you shack the target and you are swaying a fight in the favor of American forces on the ground is incredibly rewarding. Like you have the ability to come in with kind of a trump card with, you know, bombs and missiles and all the things. And that can really save American lives on the ground. It's incredibly rewarding. And then this is completely different part of the spectrum. Flying for the Thunderbirds and having those moments with kids where, especially with little girls for me specifically, where I would fly the demo, get out of the jet, go to the autograph line. And there would be that one little girl that the mom would drag up that was kind of like shy and reserved. And then she would be like, she just flew that jet. Like she was the jet that was upside down. And to see this kid's eyes light up and their face, like they get a huge smile. And then a lot of them would just start asking questions. And then all of a sudden they're just like talking nonstop and they're so excited. And it felt like that one conversation for them could have been that like life-changing pivot, right? Like that can plant a seed of inspiration where suddenly what they view as possible for themselves in the world has opened, like more possibility has arisen. And to do that for someone else is so rewarding.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of people don't know what they can do until they see someone that looks like them being able to do it. Right. So just even that visibility that you have to show someone that like, hey, I'm a girl, I can do this. Like I'm better than this guy right here, actually. So, you know, it's just like, I mean, not like trying to say you were or weren't, but like just as true, you were the ability to show someone else to do. And who knows, maybe they'll be in an all Thunderbird unit one day just because of the girls that you were able to see. So it'd be cool.
And I was, after 3 years on the team, I had a lot of interactions on social media as well, where I would, take a minute to respond to someone's question or concern or whatever around their goals or aviation focused aspirations. And, 3 years in, I was having people circle back with me and update me like, hey, I don't think you remember me, but we talked, 2 years ago and I was headed off to, there's one that really, really sticks with me. She's like, I was headed off to Air Force pilot training at Columbus, Mississippi, where I went as a non-technical major with zero flight hours. And I was like, that's literally my story. And I told her, that can be intimidating. Here's how I dealt with it. Here's how I managed my time throughout the week, blah, blah, blah. Had this like few paragraphs of a message exchange 2 years prior. And she sends me a message. She's like, I just wanted to let you know, we just had drop night and I got F-16s. And I was like, I think you're going to make me cry. Like, it's so cool to feel like you had the tiniest little role in helping push someone towards that.
Yeah, absolutely. That's awesome. I can't imagine what that would feel like. That'd just be so cool.
Yeah. So, I mean, you don't get much more rewarding than that. And that's why I do what I do now, is because of interactions like that.
So what was the most adverse situation you had to face?
My first assignment, I had plenty of stressful moments in the cockpit, but those are short-lived, right? It's a few minutes, it's an hour, whatever. My first assignment, though, getting to that base, realizing how much stuff I didn't know, how much I needed to learn. And I think for the first time ever, I was a high achiever and I worked really hard, but no matter how many hours I put in, I felt like I couldn't catch up. I couldn't get it. And that was just so demoralizing. And I kind of had this little bit of an identity crisis where I was like, if I'm not good at this, if I'm not like just being good at everything I try, who am I even? You know what I mean? Like, my whole identity was this high achiever wrapped up in the things I was good at. And you combine that with, you had asked a little bit if I had to, if in pilot training, I felt like I had to, pretend to be someone else. In my first F-16 squadron, I 100% felt like I had to put on this like fighter pilot costume, go pretend to be like type A, maverick type personality. And like one of the guys, I'm okay with, like, you can make whatever jokes you want. Like, I'm just going to go with the flow. That's like not who I really am. I'm a much more laid back. I'm like more introspective. I'm quieter. And I had to completely change who I was at work. And I could do that for a while, but it's exhausting and it's not sustainable. And you always feel like you don't quite belong. And you're always, and it just makes that feeling of imposter syndrome so much worse, because you legitimately are playing an imposter at work because you're not being your genuine self. And so I would say it was about a 2 year period, which is a long time, where I just like survived work. I just struggled through every day. I didn't want to be there. I didn't feel like anyone knew who I was. I didn't feel like I had anyone I could confide in. And if I hadn't have been under a contract with the Air Force, I would have actually left. I would have walked away from something I worked so hard to get to. So it was rough. I talk about it very openly now when I do my keynotes and stuff, because I think it kind of shocks people. And a lot of people feel that way in their careers. And I think there's some things you can do to kind of get over it. But yeah, that was a rough period of all the hard assignments I had: deployments, Thunderbird schedule, America Strong flyovers. Japan was by far the hardest.
Yeah. And I think it kind of goes to a lot. I mean, I want to say a lot of successful people, because some people are, just kind of skirt through life and they do things really well and they kind of make it, but that's rare, right? Like, it's like a lot of people have a lot of difficult moments that help mold them into the person that they're going to become. Like, those difficult moments, it's kind of when I was talking about, you're faced with a choice, right? Faced with the decision to either keep fighting on and make this not an obstacle and just like never say no and keep going and to keep building on that. And then here you are as a Thunderbird pilot, or you could have the opportunity to say no, and this moment's too big for me, or I don't want to do this anymore and walk away. Well, you couldn't walk away because you're in a contract, but go about your kind of time different. Maybe you resent or reserve to the fact like, all right, I'm not going to go any farther past this. I'm not going to become a Thunderbird pilot, but you're able to keep moving on past that and follow your dreams and get what you wanted.
Yeah. I think it normalizes it, right? People don't expect a Thunderbird pilot to have struggled with all those things. And so when you're just like, hey, I'm a human with human problems just like you, it all of a sudden makes them realize, when they're in those moments, they're like, oh, this doesn't mean that I can't go do this thing that I'm dreaming of. It just means like I'm dealing with normal human doubts and challenges at this point as I learn, because I'm new, I'm a beginner, I'm young, I'm inexperienced. All of this is kind of to be expected, but it's not the end of the journey. It's just kind of a speed bump on the way that most people go through.
Yeah. And I know we're almost done, but last thing is, what's life like after the Thunderbirds? I've flown with a guy that has flown with him maybe once or twice. He flew in the military, you know, flew F-16s, and that was the best he's ever. Like, that's the peak of his flying. Like, it's never been, but it's always been downhill since then. Similar for you, as like, is flying or career-wise, has it gone downhill, or have you kept the momentum and just kept it going uphill and still enjoyed everything?
So I've kind of taken a break from flying, which will probably shock this audience, especially, you know, 3 years with the Thunderbirds, 13 years in the F-16. My body was beat up. Number one, high G flying, 9 Gs for that long, lots of like back and neck pain, that kind of stuff. And I really wanted to rehab that. But I just needed a break from the high intensity, high stakes flying. And so I've stepped back and I'm just now starting to explore options. I'm actually headed down to the airport in Henderson as soon as we hang up to go talk to the flight school there. And I'm going to start to explore general aviation, but it's not to go pull G's and fly upside down. It's to see the beautiful views from the cockpit and take my family to cool locations. Like, my priorities have shifted. And I shut down the F-16 for the last time, feeling very, it was like kind of surreal and sentimental, but I felt very at peace with my decision. And I haven't had a single moment that I've been like, oh, I should have made a different one, because I really love what I'm doing now. I love like the purpose I have right now. I love the creative control, the schedule flexibility. I'm just really, really happy where I'm at. And so I'm definitely not, I know there's some people who, you know, they're kind of pulled out of the cockpit to retire kicking and screaming. I just wasn't in that place. I made the decision to leave and I'm very at peace with it.
Do you think there's a kind of a future of you flying 121, or general aviation is kind of as far as you think you'll go?
I think general aviation will be where it's at for me, because I, you know, I'm a business owner now. I work for myself and it's done really well. It's been really incredible last year and a half. I have a really hard time imagining going back to work for someone else after seeing the light. A lot of my friends fly for the airlines, right? And I'm like, guys, I know like it's a great time to fly for the airlines. Your seniority is like going up like crazy. You get paid well. But when they say, hey, like you have to fly over Christmas, you're like, I have to fly over Christmas. And I'm like, I can block any dates off I want. Of course, it comes at a cost sometimes for turning down business, but I have complete control of that. And that freedom coming off of 13 years on active duty, it's just such a contrast. And I'm like, man, I don't think there's any salary that could make me turn this down right now.
Everyone has a number. That's all I'll say. Everyone has a number. But yeah, no, I totally get what you're saying.
No one showed up with the number yet. So, you know.
We need CEOs knocking on your door, be like, we'll pay you more, I promise.
Yeah, it's been awesome. I really, really do love what I'm doing. So I don't know. You know, it could shift. It could evolve.
Yeah, absolutely. And talk a little bit about what you're doing right now. Like, here's a chance. Maybe someone wants to book you. Well, where do they go? What's the purpose? What's kind of the mission? Talk a little bit right now.
Yeah. So the primary thing I do a bunch of stuff, but the main thing is keynote speaking. Usually it's for corporate audiences, everything from like conferences, conventions to like smaller team meetings. I've done stuff for groups of 15 and groups of 2000. So I've also done some international stuff that's been translated. That was really fun. So I feel like my public speaking resume has grown a lot over the last year and a half. And I primarily talk about a lot of the stuff we mentioned today, you know, the flying, the cool jets, the Thunderbird videos and photos are part of the presentation, but the bulk of it is talking about facing our fears, overcoming self-doubt, dealing with feeling like an imposter, how we can push through those moments, how we can be bold, how we can make small decisions repeatedly over time that could completely change our life. And because that's what I did. That's how I went from that first assignment to the lead solo for the Thunderbirds. And so that's the topic, but my website, macekern.com, which is my call sign and my last name. If you want to see some really cool visuals, Instagram is where it's at, which is just mace_Curran. And then for really like the business, personal development, kind of more longer form stuff, we're talking about like usable takeaways, lessons learned, all of that kind of stuff. I right on LinkedIn 5 days a week. And that's just my name. You can search me on there. LinkedIn is where it's at. That's where most of my speaking business comes from.
Oh, cool.
And it's just been such a cool platform to share what I've learned in my stories.
I love it. And you didn't mention, but the book, right? Upside Down Dreams. You got a book too. So sell yourself.
Yeah. Minor detail. Yeah. We forgot the book. I have a children's book, especially for this audience. I should tell you about the children's book. That's about a little girl that wants to be a fighter pilot. It's called Upside Down Dreams. It's been out for about 2 months. It's on Amazon. You can search that title or you can search my name and find it. It's a children's picture book. So from kids that you're reading to, you know, like 3-4 years old, all the way up to like 7 years old, I would say is kind of the age range. But it's a really cool story about that moment of inspiration for a little kid where they see jets fly over and they're like become enamored with them, which I think a lot of parents have seen happen for their children. And then the main character's kind of journey through that dream, facing some doubt from herself and from her peers. And then kind of her journey back with seeing exactly like you mentioned, someone who looks like her doing the thing really solidifies it for her. And she, you know, goes on to chase that. And it's the first book in a 3-book series.
Oh, cool.
Nice. Yeah. Big announcement. There'll be another one coming out next June.
Sweet. Well, I have my kid's best friend, only friend. So naturally best friend is right across the street. It's she's about to turn 2. So I'm about to buy the book for her. So maybe she'll be the next fighter pilot. You never know.
It's a great birthday present.
Yeah, it will be a good birthday present. We'll make it happen. All right, cool. We are done. Actually, last question. Make it really short. Call sign, name, how'd it come about? How'd you get Mace? Is there a cool story? Or was it just like one day you mace someone? They're like, all right, you're Mace.
Oh, man, this is not a short answer.
Yeah. All right, we'll take
the tradition of fighter pilot. The tradition of fighter pilot call signs is that we only tell the whole story in person over a beverage. It's really just a play to get people to buy you drinks. But I will give you...
I'll Venmo you for a drink.
Yeah, right. Usually the call signs are not given. You never get to pick them. They sound cool, but they're always based on either like a play off your last name, some personality quirk that really annoys people, or something stupid that you did. Mine is the something stupid that you did. MACE is an acronym, but I'm going to not tell you what it stands for because I'm going to save that for people I see in person. Or if you're in the keynote audience, I tell you the whole story in detail. But I went supersonic when I shouldn't have. I pulled a ridiculous amount of G's. I almost G-locked. It was a traumatic experience, but I got a cool call sign from it.
Yeah, that's awesome. All right, I love it. That's good. If you want to hear it, you got to go to keynote. So there you go. How about that?
Or stop me in the airport, which a lot of people do. Really? I will get stopped in the airport. They'll be like, Mace, are you Mace? How'd you get your call sign? I'm like, I'm going to be late for my flight.
Yeah, it's like, I don't care. You told me in person. I'm here. You're going to be late.
I know. If you run into me in person, I will tell you.
All right, cool. I like it. Cool. Well, Mace, thanks for so... Wow, can't talk. Mace, thanks so much for coming on the podcast. I really appreciate it. It's been a lot of fun talking to you. I wish you the best. Good luck at the flight school down to Henderson. I was in Henderson like 3 months ago, so it was really hot when I was there. But good luck. Cool airport.
While we're recording, this is like the hurricane that's hitting California. So it's rainy and cold as far as August goes here. It's glorious. It's not 110. I love it.
It is currently 95 outside in North Carolina. So high humidity. So not great.
Yeah, I get that. Cool. You win some, you lose some.
Yeah, right. Well, have a good one. I appreciate it.
Thanks. This has been awesome.
Yeah, absolutely. Aviation, that's a wrap of today's episode. Thank you so much for listening. If you like the Pilot hats, check out Bold Aviator. They're the best hats in the world. And of course, the Pilot hat is pretty great. But Aviation, that's all I have for you today. So as always, happy flying. Pilot the Pilot LLC is compensated to make recommendations to his or her followers regarding the services of RAA or Allworth Airline Advisors, companies of Allworth Financial, LP, or Allworth. Promoter is not an employee or investment advisor representative of Allworth. Promoter is a current client of Allworth. Allworth pays promoter a fee of $4,000 a month for sponsorship of the Pilot podcast. Due to the compensation arrangement between Allworth and promoter has an incentive to recommend Allworth, resulting in material conflict of interest. Promoter's role on behalf of Allworth is limited strictly to making recommendations regarding the services of Allworth, introducing or referring prospective clients to Allworth. Promoter has no responsibility with respect to Allworth's investment advisor or other advisory services.